This is Pittsburgh Explainer from 90.5 WESA. Every week, we help you catch up on the headlines from southwestern Pennsylvania. It's Friday, January 22nd. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Liz Reed. This week, the Pennsylvania Department of Health announced that people aged 65 and older are now eligible to be vaccinated against COVID-19, as are other adults and older teens with certain health conditions. WESA's health and science reporter Sarah Bowden has been immersed in all things vaccine-related in recent weeks and is here to explain the change. Sarah, welcome back to Explainer.
Thanks for having me, Liz.
What's the state's reasoning for expanding Phase 1A, especially as we're already struggling to get frontline healthcare workers and long-term care facility residents vaccinated?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Basically, the state said that it was bringing its guidelines into alignment with what the federal government has recommended.
Is there any part of this expansion that stuck out to you as particularly noteworthy, especially as you were looking at the list of medical conditions that would qualify someone to be vaccinated?
Yeah, a couple stuck out to me. One was pregnancy. Pregnancy is considered a health risk that moves people towards the front of the vaccination line. We know that while a COVID-19 infection in a pregnant person, usually that health outcome is pretty mild, but there are heightened risks, including preterm birth and preeclampsia. But to me, this is significant because pregnant people were not included in the volunteer group for the trials. And so this has caused some angst because, you know, people are like, I don't have the data on pregnancy and the vaccine, and therefore that makes me very nervous. And so I think it's sort of a quietly profound statement that this is a health risk that's considered high enough risk that people should be prioritized for vaccination.
What are some of the other health conditions that the state listed?
Another health condition that was listed was smoking. I think this might make some people upset because you might say, well, you know, you decide to become a smoker. But to me, this indicates that both the federal and the state government is simply looking at the science. And what the science tells us is that if you are a smoker, you are more at risk for severe outcomes when it comes to COVID-19.
What I found interesting about this is that it appears that Allegheny County is sort of out of step with the state on prioritizing this newly eligible group of people. Again, people 65 and older, people with certain health conditions. What did local health officials have to say this week?
Yeah, you're right. Dr. Deborah Bogan, who is the director of the Allegheny County Health Department, she directed organizations that are administering vaccinations to continue to focus on healthcare workers and long-term care facilities. Now, there are some local organizations that have broadened their criteria just a little bit. For example, Allegheny Health Network has said that it will vaccinate recent cancer patients that are 75 and older. But really, even though we have a bigger group of people who can technically be vaccinated in Pennsylvania, supply of vaccine is so limited that in practicality, not much has changed, though I'm assuming, I think it's a pretty good guess, that there's a lot more confusion and frustration around the process now.
So even though someone is eligible, that doesn't mean they're going to be able to actually find a vaccine appointment anytime soon, right?
No. Finding those shots are going to be very hard.
I mean, we've heard, you know, even dentists who have, you know, a dozen unmasked people through their offices every day are having a hard time finding shots. What would need to happen in order to get healthcare workers fully vaccinated and then move on to these other 1A groups as Bogan suggested?
So what I can tell you about the numbers is that earlier this week, Dr. Bogan said that some 57,000 employees of both long-term care facilities and healthcare organizations in Allegheny County are still waiting for their COVID vaccinations. And the county has only received about 20,000 doses of the vaccine per week over the last couple weeks. Newly sworn in President Biden just signed a number of executive orders that hopefully will speed up the process. But I think that it's going to be a particularly long wait. So just because you are now in this new category of people who qualify for vaccinations, I think you're still going to be waiting a little while.
So as Pennsylvania Health Secretary, and now I should mention nominee to be Assistant U.S. Health Secretary, Dr. Rachel Levine says, stay home, stay calm, stay safe. even if you're eligible, you may not get vaccinated anytime soon.
Unfortunately, that is the truth.
Sarah, thanks so much for being on the show this week.
Nice to talk to you, Liz.
It's time for a quick break. We'll be right back.
Start your day with Inbox Edition, stories about Pittsburgh. Sign up for our daily newsletter at wesa.fm/inbox edition.
Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto has long said that he wants to serve the maximum 3 terms in the office. He often likens his mayoral career to a hockey game, which has 3 periods. Peduto pretty much sailed to a second term in 2017, capturing more than 2/3 of votes cast in the Democratic primary. But this year could be different. Ed Gainey, state representative and former Peduto ally, has decided to run. Here to discuss what's shaping up to be a pretty interesting mayoral primary is WESA's government and accountability editor, Chris Potter. Chris, thanks for being here.
Hey, good to be with you, Liz.
So we should just start by saying that in a town as blue as Pittsburgh, the primary is the election. So we're expecting that whoever wins the primary will be the next mayor, right?
Yeah, that's right. I don't think a Republican has won the mayoralty since the 1930s. So this is pretty much the whole ballgame coming up on May 18th.
Tell us a little bit about who Ed Gainey is and why he's running for mayor.
So Ed Gainey has, as you mentioned, he's been around for a few minutes. He was elected to his current state house seat, which is the 24th House District. That's a district that is kind of centered on Homewood and some of the adjoining communities, mostly black neighborhoods in the city of Pittsburgh. He won that seat in 2012 when he ran against his former boss, Joe Preston. Prior to that, Mr. Gainey worked for Mayor Luke Ravenstahl, Mayor Tom Murphy, doing kind of community development activities for the city of Pittsburgh. He has a reputation and a deserved one, in my view, as being a skilled kind of retail politician, active in the Democratic committee, sort of commanding presence on stage. He gives a stemwinder of a speech. As for why he's running, if you ask Mr. Gainey about it, he'll say he's concerned that the city of Pittsburgh has longstanding problems with a lack of equity in terms of race along the lines of economics, and that this problem is getting worse, and that a city that calls itself the most livable city in America simply is not the most livable city for a lot of people in Pittsburgh, both the ones in his own neighborhoods and a lot of other places that, you know, we don't talk about, the New York Times doesn't visit. So he's jumping in this race essentially because he says, you know, to kind of quote him, we have had 8 years of Mayor Bill Peduto, although he never mentions it by name. You know, if you haven't figured out these problems in 8 years, if you haven't, if you haven't developed more affordable housing in 8 years, if you haven't reformed the police in 8 years, it's probably not going to happen in the next 4. And we need to kind of address these problems now. And that's why he says he's getting in the race.
Has he laid out any specific platform proposals yet, or is it a little too early in the game?
It's a little early, I think. You know, he certainly, I mean, I spoke to him on Wednesday afternoon about the race, and, you know, I kind of tried to push him on that a little bit. He's certainly somebody who believes that there needs to be a reduction in funding in the police budget, that money that was spent on policing should be spent on social services, things like that. You know, pushing for changes to the sort of culture of policing. A lot of this stuff would be very familiar to the activists and the demonstrators who were on the streets in Pittsburgh last summer. You know, he hasn't gotten too far into the, you know, into the details of policy. He did only just announce on Tuesday evening, hours before the inauguration. So we'll give him a little time to kind of piece together this campaign and see what he comes up with.
How about Mayor Peduto? Has he, you know, it's now been at least a couple weeks since he announced his run for a third term. Has he laid out a platform for a potential third term?
I mean, you know, when you're in the incumbent, it's a little, you know, it's a little harder to sort of put out a grand vision because you're sort of still living and delivering on the grand vision that got you elected in the first place. You know, I think the challenge for Mr. Peduto is some of the initiatives that he has undertook that he talked about a lot when he first ran back in 2013. You know, some of those things have happened and been delivered on, even if it took a while. You know, there's a paid sick leave bill in the city of Pittsburgh, and it took years to get there, not through any fault of his, but because there was a protracted legal dispute over it. So some of those things have been happening. You can expect he'll be talking about those. Others, you know, frankly, the jury's still out. Affordable housing is a good option. Our colleague Margaret Krause, you know, pointed out that the city created a land bank in part to help sort of acquire properties that were blighted, delinquent, clear the title to them, and then turn them around to more productive use. That land bank was created, I think, in 2014, 2015, and it has yet to transact, make a single real estate transaction. And I think that the challenge for Mayor Peduto is to deliver on some things that have been very kind of longstanding promises, and to convince voters that he's making headway on them and that they just need to stay the course and give him one last term to kind of seal the deal on these initiatives.
How competitive do you expect this race to be, especially looking back at 2017? Wasn't super competitive. Even 2013, it was a four-way primary and Peduto got more than half the vote. Are you expecting things to be different this year?
You know, the other thing that hasn't happened in the city of Pittsburgh since the 1930s is that an incumbent mayor has lost a bid for reelection. It's very difficult to do. Pittsburgh has what's called a strong mayor system. A lot of power is vested in that mayor's office. And so a lot of the folks, whether they're unions or whether they're campaign contributors, developers, people like that, a lot of folks are afraid to get crosswise of the mayor. That is a factor that Mr. Ganey is going to have to consider. I mean, one of the issues that Mr. Ganey has is he's never been a prodigious fundraiser. He's never really had to be. He represents a district where, you know, you don't have to spend a lot of money on, you know, on mailers or on other things like that. It's a district kind of tailor-made for the kind of retail politics that he does best. So he hasn't really had to push himself that way.
I'll note that I live in Ed Ganey's district and he has showed up at my house asking for my vote.
Yeah. Yeah. The phrase Ed Ganey shows up is going to be one I have a feeling you hear a lot of, because that is kind of what he's known for doing. He was at a lot of those protests, those police accountability protests last summer. He was at a lot of them, you know, kind of speaking to the needs and for the needs and from the needs of those protesters and the community that he represents. So he does a lot of that stuff very well. And I think, too, he's got the advantage that even long before he got into this race, there were people in that community, the activist community, actively looking, trying to find somebody to run against Bill Peduto because they got frustrated with the slow pace of change on some of these issues. So, you know, he comes into it, I think, with a sort of energized base that's sort of ready to sign on to a challenger. And, you know, he's got one member of his campaign committee is Bethany Hallam, who's become kind of a standard bearer for the kind of progressive movement within the Democratic Party here in Pittsburgh. So he's going to have a lot of that going for him. The money thing is, you know, could be an issue. And it's hard to win a race without any of it. Mr. Peduto not only has $170,000 the last time I checked, which isn't a lot, but it's a good start. And he has the ability to generate a lot more. He's proven that. But, you know, we live in crazy times. Things happen on a regular basis, nationally and locally, that people didn't see coming. But, you know, it's clearly an uphill climb. Mr. Ganey started, well, I think, kind of late. I think there's a lot of questions amongst the people that I talked to almost up to a week before he actually decided to run about whether he was going to do it or not. And what that means is that he lost a lot of time, time to build relationships, time to seek out donations. A lot of that time is lost to him now, and he's going to have to make it up. So we'll see if he can do it.
Potter, thanks so much for your time.
Always good to be with you.
It's time for another break. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Noelle King from NPR. There's a lot to keep up with in the news, and one way you can help, donate that vehicle you're not using anymore. It could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thank you, and here's how to get started.
Visit wesa.fm/cars.
Staff members at UPMC's Western Psychiatric Hospital have raised concerns about lax COVID-19 mitigation measures. WESA's Lucy Perkins spoke with several frontline healthcare workers who say the result has been low morale and widespread illness among staff. Lucy, thanks for being on the show this week.
Thanks, Liz.
What kind of workers did you talk to, and what did they tell you about the conditions inside the hospital?
Yeah, so I talked to five frontline healthcare workers, as you said, who work on multiple floors of the hospital. So we know that this is happening throughout the building and not on one specific floor or unit. And you're right. They talked about how, you know, one healthcare worker will recover from COVID and then two more people will get sick. And that just has resulted in really short staffing and means that the people who are healthy to work are working really long hours and are exhausted and just tired. And they say, you know, the exhaustion kind of sticks with them when they leave the building. something that they say is contributing to these conditions inside the hospital is they say that they don't have the right masks. They say that they need N95 masks, which provide more protection to the person wearing it against the coronavirus. And in Western Psych, people working in the COVID ICU get these N95s, but not the rest of the hospital staff. And the reason that they say that this is really important is that Western Psych treats a very specific and unique patient population. The hospital treats patients with mental health and addictive disorders, which means that a lot of the patients who come into the hospital maybe don't understand or can't follow, masking recommendations and physical distancing recommendations. One nurse I talked to said that she had a patient come up recently to her floor that had their mask on their forehead. So they say that because their patients aren't wearing masks, that they need extra protection. The other thing that they talked about was protocol within the hospital. I reviewed a copy of the protocol that these healthcare workers brought up with me, and it creates yellow zones when a patient tests positive for COVID. So, the area of the floor that they were on before they tested positive becomes a yellow zone, which means that the healthcare workers who were working in that area now have to wear extra PPE, and they aren't supposed to travel or move to other areas of the hospital. The thing about this policy, though, which healthcare workers are concerned about, is that it doesn't say how long they have to stay in this yellow zone before they can move freely to other areas of the hospital that don't have COVID, which the policy refers to as green zones. So what will end up happening is that, a healthcare worker will be potentially exposed to a COVID positive patient on a Monday, and then on Tuesday they could be assigned to work in a completely different floor or wing or unit of the hospital where there aren't any known COVID patients, and testing for staff is not automatic. So they say that could be contributing to the spread of COVID within the hospitals. And what they say is that this policy should be following the same CDC protocol that, civilians are given when they are told to quarantine for 14 days after potentially coming into contact with someone who tests positive for COVID. They say that the hospital policy should align with the CDC policy, and right now it doesn't.
Now, you just said that the staff at this facility are stretched pretty thin. Is it really realistic for someone to quarantine for 14 days after working in one of these so-called yellow zones?
That's a good question. And unfortunately, according to some public health experts that I talked to, it's not realistic. I mean, the nature of pandemics is that hospitals will be short-staffed. They will be under-resourced because the spread of the virus is so great. So hospitals like UPMC may not have the staff to be able to follow, perfect epidemiological practices to a T. But what other experts I talk to say is, a good solution to boost morale is to have the healthcare workers kind of participate in crafting internal policy. So even if the situation is really frustrating and exhausting for people, at least healthcare workers don't feel like their voices aren't being heard and that they're just kind of a cog in a wheel. Because yes, experts say hospitals are in a really crummy situation too, and they're stretched really thin. But what a lot of hospitals have chosen to do is just ride their employees as hard as they possibly can, and not necessarily include them in that process.
You also reported that there's a supervisor at Western Psych who had Facebook posts expressing anti-vaccination and anti-mask sentiments. Do these workers feel that this particular supervisor's views have impacted how things are actually working in the hospital?
So I wasn't able to confirm that any specific decisions were made that needlessly increased risk for staff. But the employees I talked to were concerned about these posts. They took screenshots of them and shared them with me. And several did say that it made them scared that someone in charge of staffing decisions and just being in a supervisor's role in a hospital setting during the pandemic is scary when you see that person is posting things on Facebook that are questioning vaccinations and questioning the effectiveness of masks. This person, she's a supervisor and is an acting unit director of the child and adolescent unit on an interim basis at the hospital now. She's also a weekend administrator on duty, which means she manages weekend staffing at the hospital. Some of the posts, which we go into more detail online about, include posts from Parler, which is the conservative social media site. One of the posts that was shared from her account says, you know, quote, the CDC warned that COVID is at the stage where it can't be classified as an epidemic due to the declining deaths. And of course, we know that there are now more than 400,000 Americans who have died from COVID, and that number will just keep going up. The account also shared a meme that shows Kermit the Frog drinking tea with the caption, China's been wearing masks in public for years and still got sick, but that's none of my business, kind of, you know, questioning the effectiveness of masks, even though we know that masks are an extremely effective tool at reducing the spread of the virus. So, you know, when staff read those things, it really shocked them. One person I talked to said, you know, everyone's entitled to their own opinion, but when you're in charge of overseeing a facility that is dealing with COVID in the middle of a pandemic, it's scary to know that that person might not believe in a vaccine or the effectiveness of masks.
What did UPMC say in response to these allegations?
The first thing I should say is that we asked them specifically to comment on this supervisor's social media activity, and they asked to see the screenshots that I reported on to investigate the claims. But in their response to us, ultimately, they didn't include anything or acknowledge the questions about this supervisor at all. They did say that their staffing is meeting the demands of the coronavirus pandemic and that the hospital is continuing to provide safe care for all patients. And they did recognize that it's a stressful and challenging time for frontline workers. But they also said that, you know, any complaints or concerns should be directed to their manager.
Lucy, thanks so much for your reporting.
Thanks, Liz.
That's Pittsburgh Explainer for this week. Our show is produced by Katie Blackley. Larkin Page Jacobs is our managing editor. You can find all of our news coverage at our website, WESA.FM, and of course on the air at 90.5 FM. I'm your host, Liz Reed. Thanks for listening. Let's talk next week.